Joining us in our Wellington studio is our world weatherman, Eric Brenstrom. Good evening, Eric.
Kia ora, Karen.
Last week, the state of Texas got hammered. Is this normal for Texas?
If you went back 100 years or more, it was quite common. But what they had was a lot worse than anything they've had for 30 or 40 years. Several places actually got their coldest ever temperature on record. But nonetheless, it was made a lot worse because the equipment they were using to generate electricity at gas, from natural gas and from oil and what have you, was not properly protected against the risk of cold weather. They used the term weatherized. And they had a bad outbreak in 2011 and another one back, I think, in 1989. So they'd had warnings that their equipment wasn't quite up to scratch and that they were vulnerable to an unusual event like this. And many other states had worse conditions but did not have the electricity outages. As well, Texas has got a funny thing where it's not connected up to the national grid. They're on just their own independent grid, and this is meant to be, or what they said on CNN was this was because they didn't want to be under the regulations of the national, of the federal organisations that run the whole grid. So there was a whole lot of reasons like that, which in some way sheet over the politics, to blame for why they had such terrible power outages, which I think sometimes resulted in deaths, and a terrible amount of suffering. At one stage they were talking about, because of this emergency, we're going to have rolling power cuts, so you might lose the power maybe for half an hour or an hour, and then it'll come back on. But in fact, a lot of people lost power for more than 24 hours. And then there's that other funny thing that if electricity is hard to come by, the sort of price goes up because of the spot market over there. And so some of these poor people, after days without power, got a bill through the mail for $6,000 or $7,000 for the power that they had got. So it seemed like a real disaster made by bad planning and politics more than the fact that the weather had gone cold.
Oh, really? So in terms of the weather itself, pretty standard fear, but...
Well, standard if you went back 100 years, not so standard in the last 30 or 40 years, but sort of not without precedent, unusual. But there has been this thing with the United States that since the Arctic sea ice has been reducing so dramatically in the last 30 years, that's meant that the temperature difference between the Arctic and the tropics is smaller than it used to be, and that's affected the circulation of the atmosphere, the strength of the westerlies. And that seems to have set up a situation where some of these outbreaks have been more common in the last 10 or 15 years than they were in the, say, 20 or 30 years prior to that.
Do you think Texas will be getting prepared for this happening more in the future?
That's a really good question. From what I'm hearing, the solution has to be political. But things can change, and I think they will make some adjustments, but it might be slower than people want.
You wanted to talk also about the record temperatures last year in 2020. I hope it's not too disastrous.
Well, overall, it was considered the equal hottest year on record with 2016. By the people at NASA, who have one way of measuring global temperatures, but the people at NOAA, who have a slightly different way, thought it was second to hottest. And what was remarkable was that this could even happen during an event that we call a La Niña. And what characterises La Niña is that you have an enormous piece of the Pacific Ocean that is below average temperature by 1 or 2 degrees. And that usually means that the year as a whole is dramatically affected. So to have equaled or broken the record when a La Niña was going on is considered extraordinary.
And any comment coming from those organisations?
Well, they're always, are cautious up to a point, being government organisations, but they're certainly adamant that we're in the middle of a period where the temperatures are relentlessly increasing. And I think one of the other comments was that the last 7 years have been the seven hottest years on record. So it's not just a one-off unusual event. It's just relentlessly happening year after year that our temperatures are too high and seem to be getting higher.
Eric, just as a matter of interest, when did records start?
Oh, that's a really good question. It depends where you go. In terms of staring at thermometers and writing down numbers, you can actually get back to the 1600s in some parts of England, but certainly that's not the case worldwide. In many parts of the world, they've really only been going perhaps the last 80 or 100 years, and there's still data-sparse areas. The reason there's a difference between NOAA's opinion and NASA is because of the big areas like the Arctic, where we don't have direct measurements, although you do have satellites. But then, of course, there's other ways of looking at it aside from thermometers, and that's where you look at what they call paleoclimate indicators, and that can be oxygen isotopes in ice cores or sea shells drilled up from the seafloor. And with those sorts of things, you can have a pretty good opinion going back half a million years or more.
Very good. Now, Tropical Cyclone Yasa, tell me about that.
Well, it was another Category 5, so top ends of the scale. And one of the things that we've been seeing is that the tropical cyclones that do occur, and maybe they're only about as frequent as they used to be, but a higher proportion are reaching Category 5. And this one happened in December last year and got Fiji. So it's part of the current season, which still goes on for another month or 6 weeks. But in fact, it made the second one for the calendar year because they had a Category 5 at the end of the last season. So the Category 5 seem to be happening more often than they used to, and not just in our neighbourhood, but worldwide, and that's another sign of global warming.
Yeah, this is something with these 2020 record temperatures that you're talking about that we don't really want to focus on, but we have to, don't we, as a planet?
Well, absolutely. We do, because it's a terrific threat to food supplies, and of course it ties in with the rise of sea level, which is also a threat to sea level rise. I think I read once that the sort of sea level rise we're expecting by the end of the century could take out something like 40% of the world's food production because of drowning of river valleys near the sea, because it's those delta areas where so much agriculture goes on.
Did you watch the Perseverance landing on Mars?
I did. That was absolutely stunning. And it was also fascinating to say, here's a place where we're certain there used to be running rivers, and there's nothing like it now. So you got to see a planet where things have changed enormously over the last so many billion years, I think it is.
And when we heard the audio from that, the Perseverance rover, was that wind?
Oh, well, it was, and it sounded to me a bit like what happens when I walk down the road with my new hearing aids in.
Right, so there's wind on Mars.
Yes, and also they have little dust devils that look a bit like tornadoes, and they have been spotted in previous rover and satellites, and also the tracks that they leave across the dust have been spotted. So we've understood for quite a while now that they have tornadoes on Mars.
Wow, what else do we know about the weather on Mars? I guess this is what they're going to find out in this mission.
Well, that's right. I think it gets very cold at night, and we know they have an ice cap as well. So that's interesting. I'm not sure that this machine is capable of going anywhere near the ice cap. But it's a place of great interest. Though, you know, it's not a place I would necessarily want to go. You know, I'd rather have a holiday at the beach than a holiday on Mars.
Are you sure?
Yeah, look, the rover's doing a great job, and I'll just feed off the images they send back.
It must be amazing, though, for someone who's just focuses on the weather and knows so much about it, to see other planets around us and what the atmosphere is like.
Oh, yes, that's right. And it's not just, you know, the nearby ones, because in my generation we've had people realise that they can make measurements of distant stars, and when you see the light from a distant star dimming and then coming back, we've worked out that's because a planet's going around that star. And more than that, if you've got a very good detailed image, you can have a stab at the composition of the atmosphere of the planet going around a distant star, because the light going through that atmosphere will be characterised by the chemistry of the atmosphere that it encounters.
That's phenomenal, isn't it? really something to see that. Back on Earth, let's land back here. And this, you mentioned La Nina. So what is the state of La Nina at the moment?
Well, the current La Nina is weakening. We still have colder than average water over much of the eastern Pacific, but it's not as cold as it was before. So it's on the way out, and very often El Nino and La Nina tend to weaken away when we hit around sort of April, May, and so that's expected to happen this time. It has been interesting. The summer was thought that we might get more northeasterlies than average, which would bring rain to places from Northland to Gisborne and down Hawke's Bay way a bit, and that hasn't happened all that much. And I think we've got to remember that La Nina and El Nino only really explain about 20% of the variance in the rainfall, of the year-to-year differences. But we are also dealing with climate change. And one of the things with warmer temperatures is you get much more action in the tropics. And that means the anticyclones just beyond the tropics over us become stronger and more persistent. And I think that's influenced our summer more than any northeasterly anomaly.
What's the difference between the two?
Well, with El Nino, you get an area of warmer than average water over on the coast of South America, extending out towards almost the dateline. And this can be 4 or 5 degrees centigrade warmer, which is an awful lot. And with La Nina, it's sort of the other way around, only the temperature difference tends to be maybe 1 or 2 degrees colder. And the thing is that it interacts with the wind through the tropics in a way that reinforces the temperature anomaly that you've got. And one of the other things is that the La Nina correlates with stronger than average northeasterly or southeasterly trade winds, and that helps to lift the sea level at the western end. So, for example, we had a lot of flooding in Jakarta 1 or 2 weeks ago, not just heavy rain, but the fact that the sea level was about 20 centimetres higher than usual. And it's the other way around with El Nino. So it's a fascinating example of an interaction between the atmosphere and the ocean, where the wind pattern that develops then reinforces the original temperature difference until you get to April and May, when it tends to break down.
Aha, and the story by Peter Brannan, it's in The Atlantic, is headlined "A Terrifying Warning Lurking in the Earth's Ancient Rock Record."
This is fascinating. Geologists and paleontologists have been doing a fabulous job in the last 100 or so years, and they've built up this story about what's gone on for the last 500 or 600 million years. And there's been a number of these mass extinctions, and what they found is that carbon dioxide has had an awful lot to do with most of them. The first one, the mass extinction that ended the Ordovician period about 445 million years ago, what they think happened was there was a collision of two plates in the Earth which created the Appalachian Mountains in America. But they used to be as high as the Alps, which they're not now because they've been eroded away. But when you get mountains, you get heavier rain and you get more erosion, and the erosion captures carbon dioxide out of the air because the carbon dioxide mixes with raindrops to make a very weak carbonic acid, and that reacts with the rocks and runs down the rivers and gets buried in the sediments. The next big extinction, the Devonian, 359 million years ago, around about, they think that was because trees developed on the Earth, and the trees did a couple of things. One was their roots released phosphorus into the rivers, leading to massive algal blooms, and that used up the oxygen in the ocean, so the oceans died, and those have led to the shale deposits that they're now exploiting with fracking in the States. But also, as trees grew on the land, they soaked up carbon dioxide, so it got colder. And one of the fascinations about these olden days is that they had incredible animals that they're now finding in fossils. And in the Devonian, the top predator in the ocean was this incredible thing called a Dugliosteus, which is about the size of a camper van, with heavy bone armor plate armor on the front half. And it didn't have teeth, but it had a bone jaw with serrated edge guillotine. And they calculate that the closing force of the jaw was about the equivalent of 750 kilograms. And they even had a lovely throwaway line that maybe our fishy ancestors didn't get out of the sea because they could see food on the land. They got out of the sea to get away from this beast. So there's all those sort of side things. But again, with the Permian extinction 252 million years ago, there seem to have been massive volcanic eruptions. That puts very large amounts of carbon dioxide in the air. And ditto again at the end of the Triassic 200 million years ago. And even the Cretaceous, there's been this fascinating, sometimes acrimonious debate about the extinction of the dinosaurs. And we have evidence for this massive meteorite smashing into Mexico, which made things very unpleasant in the neighbourhood. But at the same time, there was this very large eruption going on in India, creating what's called the Deccan Traps. The Deccan Traps are like layers of lava flows that are about 4 kilometres thick. The erosion through it means when you look at a photo, it's like layer cake. And now what they've worked out is that that eruption started first, pumping huge amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Bad news for the dinosaurs and everyone else. But then when the meteorite hit, they think it caused a sort of shockwave through the Earth, and it changed the composition of the rocks coming out of the volcanoes in India and the Deccan Traps. And that meant it made that eruption much worse than it would have been. So very sobering stories.
So it's a combination of the atmosphere and the meteorites, not one or the other.
That time around it was, but on the other occasions it seems to have been the carbon dioxide levels either going wildly down or up a long way, which of course meant sea levels changed a lot. And it's a fascinating story. This bloke has also written a book, which is what I trawled through last week, called The Ends of the World, where he looks at these five mass extinctions. And I'd recommend it to anyone who's got a spare 5 or 6 days.
That's Peter Brannan, the author?
That's correct. And I think I sent the link for the article in The Atlantic, and maybe you can put that up on your website.
Absolutely. I'm sure people would love to read that, and it's got some great pictures with it as well.
Yes.
Very good. All right, well, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much, Eric, for coming into the studio tonight.
My pleasure.
And Brian will be back with you, and service will be resumed as per normal.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. That's our world weatherman, Eric Brenstrom.